So today's talk, I'm calling Compassionate Response to Our Hungry Ghosts. So we just finished the Tsujiki ceremony before Zazen. This is an annual ceremony that we do. And it formerly was called Sagaki, in case anybody's confused. Our programs in the Zendo still say Sagaki. Agaki is a term for a hungry ghost, which I'm going to describe what those are in a minute. But apparently, in Japan, the term has been used pejoratively for, I can't remember if it was an ethnic group or a racial group or a class group or something. So the Sotoshu, the Soto school, has been moving away from using that term. And Tsujiki, I can't remember exactly what it means, but it means more or less the same thing. So our Tsujiki ceremony, which is called the Festival of the Hungry Ghosts or Feeding the Hungry Ghosts. So in case you aren't familiar, in Buddhist mythology, there are six realms of existence. So there's not just heaven and hell. There is he the heaven realm, the hell realm, the human realm, the realm of the beasts, the realm of the fighting demigods. So they're not quite in the heaven realm. They're right outside the heaven realm, and they're really mad about that. And then, so that's the human, the heaven, and the fighting demigods is the three more fortunate realms. And then the six unfortunate realms are hungry ghosts, hell, and the beasts. So I won't go too much into all of that. I have a couple podcast episodes on all the mythology and imagery associated with that. So specifically the hungry ghost realm, as Shoketsu mentioned before the ceremony, according to the mythology, they're reborn in this realm. So this is the model is rebirth, right? After you die, then you're reborn into another realm. And you're reborn in the hungry ghost realm if you've been pathologically stingy, particularly, focused on a sense of lack, a sense of needing to like steal or cheat or be stingy or something, just a sense of lack, lack of generosity. And so you're reborn in the hungry ghost realm. And, the idea of all of this, using this Buddhist mythology, using this imagery is, you can relate to it how you like. There are Buddhists who believe very literally in this stuff. There are some of us who just see it as a metaphor. But I find it as a very potent metaphor. And so using some of the idea of like Joseph Campbell's power of myth and stuff, that we have these powerful images and stories, and they convey something true. Even if, word for word, they're not literally true, they convey something true, which is why we keep using this. So in some ways, the relevance to our practice of the six realms or the hungry ghosts or whatever, it's relevant to our practice whether we believe in it or we just see it as a metaphor. It's relevant. So the ceremony comes from a story, and this is probably, it's phrased very much like old Buddhist sutras, but it probably evolved in China after Buddhism went to China. But it's the story of Moggallana, one of the Buddha's disciples. And so I'm going to just read a little bit of it to you. So, thus have I heard at one time the Buddha dwelt at Shravasti in the garden of the benefactor of orphans and the solitary. Moggallana had just obtained the six penetrations. So he'd done doing a lot of spiritual practice and he actually attained some supernatural powers. And he wished to cross over to see his father and mother who had died. Whatever realm they were in, he wanted to go visit them, to repay their kindness for raising him. Thus, using his eye, his divine eye, he regarded the world and saw that his deceased mother had been born among the hungry ghosts. Having neither food nor drink, she was but skin and bones. So, as Shoketsu also said before the ceremony, the imagery of the hungry ghost realm is quite like Like if you think about the Christian, who was it, Dante, who described purgatory and hell and all that, like the Buddhists just have just as vivid a descriptions of these different realms. So in the Hungry Ghost realm, these beings, like they're usually pot-bellied of with starvation. Some of them have like just paper-thin, like as thin as grass. Their necks and their limbs are as thin as grass, so they can't get to food or sustenance, or they can't get it down their throat, or their mouths are really tiny and they can't take it in. Or some other ones, they see food and water and they go to get it, and then it like turns into blood and pus or something before they can eat it, or it disappears, or they're chased away by armed guards or something. So it just, it's a hellish realm. So Mogalana sees his mother is in this realm. Mogalana felt deep pity and sadness and filled a bowl with food and went to provide for his mother. She got the bowl, screened it with her left hand, and with her right hand made a fist of food. So, going through the motions to eat it as usual. But before it entered her mouth, it turned into burning coals, which could not be eaten. Mogalana called out and wept sorrowfully and hastened to return to the Buddha to set forth all of this. The Buddha said, "Your mother's offenses are deep and firmly rooted. You alone do not have enough power. Although your filial sounds move heaven and earth, the heaven spirits, the earth spirits, twisted demons and those outside the way, Brahmins and the four heavenly kings are also without sufficient strength. The awesome spiritual power of the assembled Sangha of the Ten Directions is necessary for liberation to be attained. I shall now speak a dharma of rescue, which causes all those in difficulty to leave worry and suffering and to eradicate obstacles from offenses." The Buddha then told Moggallana, the 15th day of the 7th month is the Parivana day for the assembled Sangha of the Ten Directions. For the sake of fathers and mothers of 7 generations past, as well as for fathers and mothers of the present who are in distress, you should prepare an offering of clean basins full of hundreds of flavors, and the 5 fruits, and the other offerings of incense, oil, lamps, candles, beds, and bedding, all the best in the world, and to the greatly virtuous assembled Sangha of the Ten Directions. You make this offering to the Sangha, and then the Sangha says chants and verses and does the religious ceremony on your behalf. So they do that. And then at the time that Bhikshu Moggallana and the assembly of the great Bodhisattvas were all extremely delighted, and the sorrowful sound of Moggallana's crying ceased. At that time, Moggallana's mother obtained liberation from 1 kalpa of suffering as a hungry ghost. So she was, or an eon, very long time. And the Buddha says this ceremony can be done again in the future. So part of the Buddhist cosmology is that no one is stuck permanently in any of these realms, even the heaven realm. So even the heaven realm is not permanent, and you don't get to take it for granted. So you're not stuck in the hungry ghost realm forever. There's a sense that you're working stuff out as you're there. So like that's what we enacted with our Sajiki ceremony today, was making an offering. We cover all the Buddha images in the room. We open the door and we make a special altar right by the door, and we cover it with junk food, which, the hungry ghosts, the idea is that if they were able to accept the Dharma, if they were really able to accept the truth, they would be freed from their suffering, but they're not ready. So they remain trapped. So they're not ready to accept the truth, but they might be ready to accept a donut. And if we offer it in kindness, maybe a little bit, they'll pick up a little bit of dharma at the same time. So it's interesting, Kyogen, when he was giving a talk on Sajiki one year, he said he had just had a Chinese visitor to the Zen Center who told him a little bit about how the ceremony is dealt with and held in China. And if anybody knows differently, you're free to, free to speak up later and let me know. I'm just repeating what I read from Kyogen. He says, in China, the seventh lunar month is the month of the dead. Nowadays, during this festival, many Chinese believe all the ghosts have been released from hell and other realms for the entire month, like a great vacation. During this time, people pay respects to all their ancestors and make offerings to them, particularly of food. But they also make offerings of entertainment, like Chinese opera, puppet shows, spectacles, and circuses. Anything people think the ghosts might enjoy. The entire month becomes a huge celebration and a time of great happiness when people feel very close to their ancestors, whether they happen to be in the realm of the Gakis or elsewhere. This quality of celebration is the same as the offering of dancing and joyous music done at Obon in Japan. Rather than being grim or solemn, the whole affair is very joyous, even raucous. In China, popular legend also has it that after giving aid to his mother, Mogalana made a vow to once again enter hell, or the Hungry Ghost Realm, and he vowed to do his own practice there on a permanent basis for the sake of those suffering in that realm, saying, if I do not do so, who else will? So he became a bodhisattva or enlightenment being dedicated to helping others before enjoying final enlightenment himself. And to this day, he's venerated for this act of great compassion. So today I wanted to talk about our hungry ghosts. So for some of us, we may actually have hungry ghosts who are our ancestors in some way. No human being is perfect. Even decent, well-meaning people aren't perfect, and they leave behind some unresolved stuff. Perhaps things said in anger, things not said or done, miscommunication. Our ancestors sometimes were living in very difficult circumstances, very different contexts from today. So you might think and reflect in what sense might some of our ancestors' terrible actions still be causing suffering today? Some of us whose ancestors participated in the system of racially justified slavery, or participants in the widespread system of gender-based slavery, or the genocide of indigenous peoples. So I sense there's some hungry ghost energy created through all of that. And then there's hungry ghosts in the sense of our own resentments, bad habits, favorite delusions. So what things in ourselves, what things in our practice seem to resist the Dharma? And this is, I think, for me, the effective definition of a ghost. Some part of ourself which cannot accept the truth. It can't recognize like the deeper longing, which can only be filled through spiritual understanding, healing, acceptance, practice, liberation, letting go. But this part of ourselves is not ready to fully embrace that path. So we keep trying to requite our longing in other ways, like material possessions, searching for safety and security, dependent on relationships with others, longing for status and power, knowledge and control, numbing out or distraction, looking for love in all the wrong places, that I like to say. We're seeking for some kind of permanent satisfaction or refuge in stuff that will not give us that. What parts of you, despite years of thinking about it, despite therapy, despite trying to let go, diligent Buddhist practice, meditation, remain obstinately angry or resentful, reactive, injured, avoidant, obsessed, addicted, attached, stuck in less than healthy patterns of behavior in body, speech, and mind? I think it helps to recognize these as hungry ghosts. This is one of those utilities of these of the metaphor. Like, it doesn't really matter whether you believe in any extent to the reality of it, if you just to think about it in terms of these are our hungry ghosts. We're acknowledging their existence. We're acknowledging their continued suffering and the way that they continue to perpetuate suffering. They continue to, you know, seek suffering, hold on to things that cause suffering. But then we're also not identifying with them. We're not incorporating whatever unresolved stuff there is into some grand sense of I, some grand executive I who should be able to fix everything today, which clearly we're not. But we hold on to that delusion that somehow I'm going to stop doing that. I'm not going to feel that way anymore. And it just doesn't work, right? So we have these hungry ghosts. And as the Buddha says, he's explaining to Moggallana that, you know, no matter how much you love your mother, no matter how sincere your prayers, you alone don't have the power to liberate her. He says, your mother's offenses are deep and firmly rooted. So, and only participation of the whole Sangha made a difference to Moggallana's mother. So what does this signify for us? We can't liberate our hungry ghosts through sheer force of will. The causes of their ghostly manifestations go back in time and are deeply rooted. They're likely to be around causing misery and mischief for some time. But we don't give up. Just as hungry ghosts aren't permanently, you know, doomed to be in the hungry ghost realm, our hungry ghosts, you know, at some point, sometime, may learn something, may ease up, may be liberated. At the same time, we draw a boundary between us and the ghosts, right? We're not over-identifying. We're recognizing a need to contain their havoc. There are some motions that the celebrant does during the Tsujiki ceremony, going up to the altar and, you know, kind of opening the realm of the hungry ghosts, but also doing some protective mudras. So the idea is we're inviting them in, but we're also like, okay, don't make too much of a ruckus. So a beautiful ceremony, which we don't do here because we don't have a children's program right now, but someday maybe. At Dharma Rain, they have a large children's program. So the children have their own Tsujiki ceremony, which I feel is just as symbolic and valuable as the adult one. So they will start chanting just the same way, like they're enacting the same ceremony as the adults. So they're chanting away, and then at some point, like through the open door, because the door is still open, through the open door, a bunch of gakis come in, who are the middle schoolers dressed up in sheets. But you know, there's little kids there who are just like, ooh. And then there's the older kids who are like, I know what's going on. But it's all very sweet. So the gakis come in, and you know, there's ways that you act in the zendo, right? You take your shoes off ahead of time, you come in, you might make a bow at the door, you know, walk right up and start messing with stuff on the altar, whatever. So the gakis come in, they've got their shoes on. You know, they just start clonking around and like picking stuff up and all this. And so the kids have been, they're coached to like, maybe you can teach the gakis something. And so the little kids go up and they like, they try to fit candy through the little mouths and, you know, feed them. And then they like, they say, why don't you take your shoes off? And then they teach them how to like make a little bow. And then we need to, you know, tell the gakis to go. So, you know, like the gakis come in and there's a little bit of chaos, but then we teach them a little bit and then we send them on their way. So, and then I guess in the Chinese version of the Moggallana story, he when he goes to see and help his mother, he breaks the lock on the Hungry Ghost realm and they all get out. So the festivals are done in part to convince them to return to where they need to be. It's like you get out and party for a while and we can convince you to go back. There's always a way out of the realm. It's just a matter of time, of patience, of keeping the intention to liberate this hungry ghost, but recognizing it may not be ready for liberation yet. And in the meantime, we make offerings. We treat these hungry ghosts with some compassion and patience, and try to slip in whatever little amount of dharma we can at a time. So, as an example, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but I would say my ghost or one of my ghosts is obsessed with busily trying to fix and improve everything in the world, as if at some point perfection is attainable and the ghost will find peace. And then, this is the kind of thing which for most of us, it operates at this very subconscious level. At the conscious level, I may be doing, that's a good project, that's a good thing, that's something that needs to be taken care of. It's kind of a compulsion underneath that has this hungry ghost quality. So what dharma does my ghost need to accept? Now, I think it's if it was so simple that you could just come up with an extra intellectual answer for the hungry ghost, then we wouldn't have ghosts, right? If I could just tell myself that part, like, perfection is impossible, so stop being obsessed. Okay, but that doesn't actually change anything. That doesn't, the hungry ghost is unmoved. The hungry ghost is not going in. So then we think, well, what does the hungry ghost really want? What does this hungry ghost within me really want? And is there some way that I can, try to point toward that or give it that in another way? So, I guess this ghost wants to get to a point where, to be able to be at ease, just to be is enough. Not to be constantly having this sense that, now what's the next thing that has to happen? To just being alive is enough. There's a sense in which this life is already complete. So, I might remind that ghost as I'm sitting zazen, and that ghost is like, all right, thinking about this, thinking about that, and just, yeah, that's a good project. Oh, interesting. Yeah, you could just, relax here for a moment. Everything is complete. It's a little gentle smack on the Sagaki altar that maybe the ghost can settle for a moment. So a classic ghost for many of us, many people, subsists on lingering hurt and resentment from cruel or selfish behavior on the part of our parents, or maybe other significant people in our life, but it's often apparent. And anything that reminds us of the parental stuff awakens this ghost, pulls us into old patterns of behavior, speech, or thought, and makes us re-experience the fear or the shame or the hurt or the anger, the rejection that formed this ghost to begin with. And we may understand intellectually that this ghost's continued existence is irrational. We may intellectually realize our parents were just doing the best they could, or we're no longer under our parents' control, or maybe our parents aren't even alive anymore. And yet the ghost lives. And for a while, it may seem to be gone, but then It comes in through the door again. So I feel like ghosts are a good metaphor for the power of karma, our lack of direct control over all of this. So what might we offer this kind of ghost? Acknowledgement, acceptance, compassion. We're not trying to control or fix or eliminate the ghost. We understand, like, if we just go at this ghost with, like, all right, they're gonna just run back out the door. And then they're gonna come back again, surprise, at some later date. So we have to be gentle and cautious and not try to cause too much change at once. Self-compassion, acceptance. And ultimately, for this kind of ghost that's based on this past trauma, the liberating Dharma will be connecting with our Buddha nature, seeing how our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. And in the context of that realization, the cruelty or selfishness of our parents seems almost ridiculous. Certainly pathetic, a sign of their own suffering and delusion. And compassion for them arises in us. But in the meantime, we might just live with a ghost. And we don't know when the ghost's process will be over, when their time in the hungry ghost or hell or beast realm will be over. I like to think sometimes in our practice about, as I'm sitting Zazen, occasionally I imagine opening the doors of my mind like we open the door, the Sagaki for the Sajiki ceremony. It's like, all right, what's out there? Okay, come on in. Because it's all, sometimes I feel like we're pretty good at just kind of pushing stuff away that's kind of uncomfortable or forget about that. We'll just sit here and just enjoy our breath and enjoy this moment. But there's a lot that's there that has not come to the surface yet. So I feel like sometimes that just that conscious intention to open the mind when we're feeling safe and strong and opening the mind to, like, all right, what's going to come up? At Dharmarain, they do a whole retreat around this. It's a weekend-long retreat. So starts on a Friday evening, goes all day Saturday, and on Sunday it goes all day as well. And so they do this Sajiki ceremony that we did in the morning, and then they do another ceremony in the evening about kind of burning karma slips, letting go of karma. So it's very sweet, but the whole weekend is kind of in the context of the retreat. From the very beginning, you're opening those doors of the mind to unresolved stuff. So there's this sense of kind of safety that you're with Sangha, you're letting this, going to allow this stuff to come off if it wants to, but you're surrounded by support. You're in a context where people understand this is what you're doing, and can be very powerful. So I will leave it there. Any comments or questions? And anybody on the cloud, just under the reactions button, there's a little raise hand. And so if you want to say something, go ahead and raise your hand and then I'll call on you in order. Or you can use the old-fashioned way too. And anybody in the Zendo, go ahead and raise your hand, but then you can come up here so you can be seen and heard by the cloud. Cheerio.
I will try and be not emotional, but that was the best description I have ever heard of an addict in the throes of his or her addiction. And what that person goes through, and the fact that will not do it. And there has to be something spiritual there. But that's not why I came up here. Golly. You know, you asked the question about the hungry ghost. What does the hungry ghost really want? I think the hungry ghost really wants love. More than anything. Love, appreciation, and they don't know how to get it. And the other thing I was going to comment on was, you know, the unresolved karma and working with that. I know in my own case, I can get that to a place where it's all good. And then, you know, 6 months from now, Christmas time, it comes back for a little bit. And the fact that I've gone through a resolution process makes that easier. But I don't have any expectation anymore that it's going to go away. Thanks.
Said very well. Yes, Shade Soki.
Hi. I also thought that was a wonderful explanation of the hungry ghosts. Quickly, I just want to say there was a time when I was got to be a gaki up at Great Vows, and out hiding out in the woods at dusk, and the little kids come out with candles, and I was instructed to be scary but not terrifying, resistant but not obstinate, so that they could bring me inside. Several times they'd have to come and get me again, and eventually to participate in this lovely ceremony with them in front of their very, very large Kashida Garba that they have. There was something that you said today that put, let's see how, you can be on the path, even if you're not consciously aware of it, that things are going in a more opening and expansive direction. And then something that can happen was kind of like, and it just triggers you on a on an unconscious level. Later on, you can get to the conscious understanding of it, but on an unconscious level, usually by people who are very close to you, this is what happened to me anyway. And all of a sudden, I was taken back. I slipped through this hole, a seam in the atmosphere, for lack of a better word, and was back. I was a gaki again, hungering for something that I wasn't even aware of, and it was back into a parental place, or not a parental place. Re-experiencing some childhood trauma, okay? And so I made decisions from that place where I had slipped back into this teeny tiny little opening. I don't know if I'm being clear or not. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't even know you could slip back like that. And it wasn't until a couple years later that I consciously knew what happened. I said, oh, damn, I slipped through that little hole that I didn't even know was there. So I appreciate the way you shared it, because you probably explained it a lot better than I did. I'm just saying experientially, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. And that also came to mind is a wonderful book by Gabor Mate called The Hungry Ghosts, about people who are living down and out on Skid Row in Vancouver, and their addictions, and how hard it is to really help these people, and yet how careful you have to be in talking with them, because they're feeling so much trauma and so much shame and so much pain, And one of the beauties of this book is that here he is, the medical quote unquote professional, acknowledging all the addictions that he has, that he too is a hungry ghost just like them. It's just that he's not living it in the streets and homeless. And so my experience from slipping through that hole and moving forward, and with other people I've interacted with, it's these gawkies are hungry and amiss. It's not because they're criminal or horrible, or that we want to shut the door and push them away, but really invite them in with so much delicacy and tenderness and gentleness and an open heart. It doesn't mean you allow yourself to be subjected to abuse, but there's so much healing in that open-hearted tenderness and gentleness to let them to reveal, this is what's really hurting. This is why I'm so hungry. This is what can't be filled in me by any other way. But with your open heart connecting to my open heart, somehow I can be filled. Anyway, that's what came to mind.
Thank you, that's beautiful. Greg.
Hi. Yeah, I just had kind of a stupid question that doesn't really do justice to the last two very serious comments, but I've never had I have a pretty modest altar, and I've never put a perishable edible offering on it before, and I'm not really sure what to do with all this food. Now the hungry ghost left a lot behind for me to deal with, and I don't know, is it more appropriate to eat it myself or give it to trick-or-treaters tomorrow or put it in the compost? What do I do with it now?
The only specification that is that it should be eaten. It doesn't matter by who. So it on occasion, you know, something might be have gone beyond and you can feed it to the worms in the compost, but you know, ideally, you know, it's eaten by people. So like we took the donuts off the altar and we made pretty short work of them during the break. So good question though. Mark.
You did something that surprised me in the talk, which is that you characterized your drive towards perfection as one of your ghosts. And I see you as a very dynamic and hardworking person. So I would also characterize that as your power, right? Or as your innate vitality. How do you navigate the relationship between a ghost, which is something that needs to heal, and the ghost as your own life? How do you navigate that gulf?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. So if I put it in terms like this, does this make sense to you? How do I recognize this ghost and try to heal this ghost, but also not like cut off or kill this
and use it,
and
right,
positive energy or power or whatever? Yeah, I mean, I think that's what makes it so difficult sometimes. Like in some ways, like the ghosts are looking for something, and it's what they're looking for is not wrong, right? If they're looking for love, if they're looking for peace, they're looking for satisfaction, they're looking for ease. Like, that's not an entirely deluded movement. And yet there's some kind of there's an extra compulsion underneath it, which
goes
so,
wrong.
Huh?
It goes wrong.
It twists things, and it gives everything an extra edge, and it
hurts people.
And so I did set aside as much as possible, as much as was humanly possible. I set aside my improving mind. Well, I didn't set aside the mind, but I set aside enacting it for my junior monkhood. That was, you know, Gyokoko, my teacher, could see that was my thing. So while I was a junior monk, I mean, she told me, so you were living in a communal household, and she said, don't rearrange anything anybody else puts in the dishwasher. And like, and I had, she held me to that standard of behavior in everything. And it was a little bit cruel, but she actually turned, because I would have these ideas and comments and whatever. And she actually, like, in our social situations of supper and whatever, she'd actually kind of undermine me in that setting. She'd actually make some kind of comment like, well, you know, whatever. And then other people took that up. And pretty soon, like, nobody thought my ideas were great. Nobody wanted to listen to it and improve. Like, and it was really, really hard. You know, I was so identified with that to be just like, you know, who am I? I'm not worth it. Nobody loves me. You know, and in a sense, we want that peace and that love. And I do think that actually having to set that aside helped clarify some stuff, because I had to find the meaning, the reason to be, even though I wasn't improving anything. Like, what is this about? Why would my teachers not want me to improve anything? Like, what? So I had to reach within and learn to feed some of that need in a different way. So that was good. But, you know, subsequently to that, after I left junior training, I mean, the world's wide open. The world just wants all the energy you can have, all the improvement that, you know, so I've just been able to go back and just indulge that every single day, every moment. And, you know, the hungry ghost is not fully liberated. Maybe, you know, more liberated. It's not completely obsessed. I do know how to just, okay, you know, if you can't recognize how everything is perfect as it is in a way, then what's the whole point? You're never going to get to that stage of that place of perfection and ease. But I don't know. I guess one part of it helps me, and I don't know if anybody else has this kind of thing where there's like a positive aspect of your being, but it's all kind of mixed up with the hungry ghost or compulsion or something. I'd have to reassure myself that practice does not mean I don't try to help. I have to reassure myself it may look like that's what it means, but it doesn't mean that. So trying not to fall into dualism, trying not to fall into this sense that it's either you run around like a chicken with your head cut off trying to improve the world, or you do nothing. Either one of those is extreme. So I have to remember, like, you know, my ideal is to be able to pick this all up with a sense that it's optional, at least with respect to my own well-being.
Thank you.
Paulette?
This reminds me, thank you for this talk. It reminds me of the Tibetan practice, feeding your demons. Is it similar? You know the practice I'm talking about?
No.
Oh. There's a practice, and it's Tibetan. I think it's very, very old, from the Chod tradition. And you sit and you imagine your demon in front of you, in any shape you want. It could be funny, it could be scary, it could be neutral, and you talk to it and you ask it what it wants. And it tells you. And then you I think you actually change places with it. You take in whatever it's telling you. I'm not sure exactly how it works. It's been a while, but you feed it, basically, whatever it's asking for. And then it becomes you. Mm. And you're one. And it's a really cool practice, and it's very, very healing. You can do it multiple times. It can be different every time. It can be the same thing every time. But I've done it a few times, and it was helpful.
Wow, thanks for sharing. That sounds cool. It does make me, I think, there's different ways we can interpret this metaphor, but at least in my experience, I think a lot of what disturbs our zazen is kind of hungry ghost energy. We may just think kind of like, oh, you know, my mind's really busy, or I can't stop thinking about this particular, you know, it's always on this particular loop or whatever. But I feel like that kind of compulsive energy has a hungry ghost kind of thing behind it, right? So it's worth examining what kind of stuff disturbs your zazen. So for me, you know, it's my zazen is full of this ghost trying to improve everything. And even if there's no problems, immediate problems in my life to solve, which of course there always are, right? I swear to God, or especially early on in practice, I would design shelving. There would be some storage area that was full of stuff, and I would design shelving to fix it. And I never built the shelving. It never came to anything, but that's what my mind was doing during Zazen. So, I mean, where other people, you know, it's ruminating on the past and on past hurts. And, you know, trying to maybe figure out what was that about and how can I protect myself from that kind of hurt in the future? Or, you know, some people it is worry and anxiety. How am I going to take care of my loved ones and myself? And so it's, you know, kind of similar to my improving mind, but really focused on, you know, taking care of loved ones and solving problems. And so I feel like, you know, then it might be helpful to turn toward it and, you know, maybe even do something like Paulette was talking about. And just, there's different, you know, in voice dialogue is another version of this and stuff where you're just imagining this thing not as yourself. You're imagining it as something obviously that's related to you, but you're able to distance yourself enough to kind of listen, inquire, what is going on here? What is this? What is it? And what do you really want? And in a compassionate way, not a way, because usually what we want to do is just get rid of those thoughts, rid of those feelings, rid of all of that. But this is asking us to turn with kindness and listen and not figure that they're going to go away right away either, right? Paulette.
Yeah, I just wanted to add... So you only become one with it after you've fed it. And it's actually a lot of times, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of ritual in it. So it would be like this nectar is coming out of your body and going into this other body, or in the form of like nectar or some kind of white or yellow light or something like that. So there's always that kind of imagery that goes with it. And then it becomes you. So it's like you've kind of worked through whatever it is, and then you become one with it. It's a whole process. There's books on it and stuff. So I'm sure that there's better ways to find out about I don't know if I'm exactly accurate, but.
Well, I like that that idea of kind of just sending the sustenance, sending the food without necessarily like it being that specific. Like, I mean, you have asked it what it wants, but to some extent, it's almost like we don't even really understand why these ghosts are the way they are. And I like that sense of just like, here, just have some goodness. was it somebody? Yeah, I want to come up here.
I like the expression of best is the enemy of good. Mm. And I also appreciate that, you know, I'm numerical. So if you'll imagine a line that goes from 0 to 100, and we're standing at 0, if we have anything that takes us to 1 or anything at all, it's infinitely more than 0. Those two statements are somewhat related. And what I'm getting at, similarly, if we're at 99%, but we're not perfect. You know, we're 99% good, but we're not, we've always got something left. And there is certainly that wish, that desire that we could fill it out and be perfect and not have anything missing. I feel like, well, here's the question. Is hungry ghost a little redundant? I mean, is there a ghost that's not hungry? I mean, because it's just like, I'm 99%. I just want to get to 100. That's all I want.
Probably not. It probably is redundant. Ghost. Hungry. Maybe we just say hungry so we understand. But I think almost every culture has this idea, right, of ghosts, of beings, of energy that lingers because it hasn't gotten what it wanted. So, yeah.
And so I might think of ghost as synonymous with hungry.
Yeah.
And that I'm looking to tame that and just live with the hunger and just, okay, be with that. Let the dishwasher sit as it is. Yeah. I got this. Okay.
All right. Well, it is 12:14, so I will just sing our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.